This is part two of the Abby Wasserman oral history. It is February 11th. This is Stella Peroni and Abby Wasserman.
Well, we talked about going back to eighth grade graduation from Alto School. What I remember about the eighth grade graduation was that we were given a song to sing, and the song was based on the Gettysburg Address. So the song started out with the Gettysburg Address, the first part of it, and then the words, "Thus spake the man from," I can't remember all the words, but it was a very affecting song, very beautiful. And I believe it was at graduation that we performed that. And we would have had graduation, I think, I guess it was at Tam High, at gymnasium maybe. That's what I remember, is that we graduated in the gymnasium, which wasn't yet named for Gus Gustafson because he was still living when I was in high school. I entered Tamil Pius High School in 1954, and I was just 14. And a lot of the same kids that I'd gone to school with, either at Park, Old Mill, Homestead, were with me going through, that would have been 6th, 7th, and 8th grades. So we entered TAM, and it was very interesting to see how people broke up into groups. We also were in school for the first time with African American kids from Marin City. Our friends who went to Richardson Bay School from Sausalito, who were white, had gone to school with these same kids during their elementary school years. So they knew them.
The kids who went to Richardson Bay School, were they Mill Valley kids?
No, Sausalito and Marin City, as far as I know, were the only two places. And that Richardson Bay was an elementary school.
The reason I'm asking is I did an oral history on somebody, and she was telling me that her kids, that some kids from Mill Valley were shipped out to go to Richardson Bay School.
That would have been, I think it was around 1964, although that would have to be checked. But in 1964, the first black teacher in the Mill Valley schools, Shirley...
Hasley.
Exactly. Shirley Hasley. And I don't think she was married at the time, so her name was probably her maiden name. She, in her very first year at Park School, she had just been hired. She was asked to be one of, I think, two teachers from Park who went over to Marin City, to Richardson Bay School, to have an exchange of students. Now, the interesting thing about that is that none of the black kids were invited to come over to Mill Valley School. It was the white kids who went over to Richardson Bay School. And I don't know the details of that, but that she was the teacher. And
it's kind of interesting that they had the black teacher.
Exactly, yeah. Well, there had been a certain amount of, and this, of course, I didn't know firsthand because I was gone. I was out of the country by this time. But they did. There was some unpleasantness. I was reading Shirley's oral history. I've never met her, but she sounds like a marvelous woman. She taught 26 years at Park School and then was laid off from Park and was picked up by Edna McGuire and taught more years at Edna McGuire and was really one of the great teachers, I think, for people of that generation. But she said in her oral history that there were parents who were objecting to having their children in the same class that she was teaching that very first year, or she was going to be teaching that first year. And the superintendent who had hired her basically said, "You don't want to be in her class, you can go to another school." And I thought that spoke very well for the school system, even though she wasn't able at that time to find an apartment or a place to live in Mill Valley. No one would rent to her. Oh, the one person who said he would rent to her had some of his windows broken, and some threats of burning a cross on his lawn, and she decided to withdraw from that. So anyway, so the kids, in a recent reunion with some of my classmates, some of my friends from Tamalpais High School who had gone to school at Richardson Bay with their African-American counterparts, our friends who graduated with us, they knew so many things that I didn't know. Their taste in music was way advanced. They knew about gospel music. They knew about blues. They just had a very different experience as young kids. But when we all came together at TAM, people split up into factions. But the nice thing about TAM, and I think this is even more true when you get to college, is that everybody found their niche. Everybody found their group to be within. And the kids were kind of, at TAM, we were kind of divided between the senior bench crowd, well, when we became seniors, but the kids who were going off to college, who were college bound, who were taking the X classes, so many of them.
What do you mean by X classes?
They were the advanced, more advanced classes. And the kids who were going into auto mechanics, woodworking, print shop. There were wonderful classes, vocational classes too. But everybody was fairly friendly. You know, it was you didn't maybe hang out with all the kids, but you had friends across the groups, at least I did. And there was, speaking of black and white, and there was a certain amount of reluctance to date, for example, across the races, but and very few people did that, but that was much more likely to happen among the kids who had been with in an integrated school from the time they were very young. And Mill Valley had some kids who were Latino background, some of course Portuguese, many of them from families who had been here for way longer than my family had been here. And so there was some diversity, but not a great deal in elementary school.
Who were your best friends at TAM High?
Ah, my best friends. My best friend was Jackie Majora. That was in our senior year. And Jackie was incredibly talented in art. She was funny and delightful, and she and I would have pajama parties at each other's homes, and we would make pizza. There was a packaged pizza that we would get, and we would make pizza together and talk. And I remember one time we went to her stepfather's place, I think it was, in Oakland, and he had an indoor swimming pool. And so I remember swimming with Jackie at night in the indoor swimming pool. But I loved her very much, and we were very tight. And then after high school, we didn't see each other. And then she died in an auto crash when she was, I think, only 19. Another very good friend was Kathy George, who was the daughter of John George, who was the dean of boys at TAM when I was there. And Kathy, I remember, again, overnight party with Kathy, who was a little bit younger. She's still a friend. She still lives. She lives in Mill Valley. And we were listening to Frank Sinatra records the whole evening. And I think probably having cocoa and cookies that her mother brought us. It was just lovely. I remember one time during high school. Well, I'll go back to friends. My friend Carol Foss from across the street was always a friend, even though we went very different directions in high school. Carol became a majorette, and she knew how to twirl a baton. So we'd been friends growing up because she was just across the street. But in high school, we didn't hang out very much together. But Carol lives in Mill Valley, and she's still a friend. I feel very grounded in the friends that I made in those lower grades in high school. when I came back to Mill Valley. It's a great thing. Other friends were people that I knew through the community church, which is the United Church of Christ affiliated, but was then the Congregational Church in Mill Valley at Olive and Throckmorton. And my parents were, as I said before, my mother was from a Methodist family and my father was Jewish, but both of them were agnostic. And they had actually a great interest in common with the Synoptic Gospels and the study of Jesus as teacher, and writings by H.B. Sharman and by other people who had studied the Gospels and were approaching the Bible in a very different way, more progressive, perhaps. And so they affiliated very loosely with the community church, my mother more than my father, but one of my father's best friends was Gordon Foster, the minister of the church. And I think that they met on many different levels, but the chief one was that they both were interested in dialogue. They loved talking about things together and hashing over ideas and scholarship. And Gordon was a wonderful minister, endlessly kind, and he led that congregation for many, many years. He and his wife Marjorie lived on the corner of Elma and Throckmorton in that marvelous house. I'm just beginning to learn a little bit more.
On the level side or on the Throckmorton side?
On the Throckmorton side.
The big brown shingle
yes,
with
the
orange tree.
Three-story house, yeah. And interestingly, Mildred Mancha, who has an oral history in the history room, who was born in Mill Valley, but I didn't know that until I read the oral history. She was our seamstress. She made clothes for my mother and for me. And she lived right there. I think her brother may even have owned that Elma house. So everything begins to come together, you know, once you start studying the history of the place. So what the community church offered us was, and my brothers, John and Rich and I all went to the youth group. They had a wonderful program for young people. And the advisors were Millie and Ben Young, a longtime Belvedere-Tiburon couple who were pretty young then. And they were just the best chaperones, the best people to talk over problems with, the best people to do any study of religious thought with that we could have possibly had. So the community church had two youth groups. One was called Redwood League, and that was for the younger kids, probably about, I would say, junior high age, and Mirror League, which was the older kids, the high school kids. And we were all active in those youth groups, and I think they probably kept us out of a lot of trouble, although my brother Richie did manage to get in some trouble. I got my first job when I was at Tamalpais High School at the drive-in, Mill Valley's first drive-in, which was on Miller Avenue within very little distance from the high school.
C's,
yes. And Caesar, I can't remember his last name, but I will find it out. Caesar, whom Chuck Oldenburg has written about in one of his homestead, you know, memory lane kinds of things. Caesar hired me when I must have been 14. And I remember...
Was it new then?
It was new. And it was it was good to have a job, but it was a little bit painful, because I had to wear a hairnet. And my, you know, kids from high school would come while I was working. You're nodding your head, you know what I'm talking about. But I worked there for maybe, I don't know, 6 months maybe. It wasn't even an entire year. But I worked at the counter and Caesar was behind doing the cooking.
Burgers, fries, shakes, is
yep.
that correct?
Yep, burgers, fries, shakes. And there's, I remember the French fries were frozen. So they would go, they were packaged French fries. He would, you know, put them in the cooker, in the deep fry. And the onions were dehydrated. Now, this was probably 54, 55, around there. And so I guess that kind of makes sense. But anyway, I didn't have to cut up onions. I was looking in my Tamil Pious yearbook, and I was active in a lot of clubs. I was very active in high school. There was the, at different years, this would have been, I'm mixing them all up. I was in the Pep Club. I was in Junior Statesman. I ran for song leader twice, lost both times. I remember going to Bakersfield with other junior statesmen where there was a mock convention where people would be elected. I know that I have some notes on this. I'm not sure that they're right here. But it was, I was very, very active in high school, and I wasn't terribly keen on my studies. I did enough to get by. I remember my poorest subjects were French and chemistry, for sure. I had no idea about chemistry and anything having to do with mathematics. And my favorite subjects were writing, English, typing, which I really loved. And I loved Ted Mitchell's oral interpretation class. Ted later became the principal of Tamil Pious High School. But I loved giving talks. I loved giving speeches. One of the things, in fact, that I enjoyed very much about the community church was I liked to give sermons. We would have little worship services. I liked to think about something that I wanted to say and, you know, try to extrapolate my learned experience or what I was reading or what other people told me. And I liked being in front of people. And that's not surprising that I loved those things because I became an actress, amateur actress, but I did a lot of acting in high school. And I became a writer and an editor. Some of the teachers I remember at Tamil Pious High School, there were so many good ones. Mary Baker taught phys ed. Catherine Flanagan was kind of, we always thought she was a bit racy. She was someone who could talk to the girls right at our level. And she had a real twinkle in her eye. And I had her for sewing and cooking, home ec. Victor Rao was a very serious person, but a very, very nice man. I had him for English. Dean Potts, Mr. Potts, I believe I had for chemistry.
Is he related to Steve Potts?
That I do not know. But Mr. Boosie, Henry Boosie, who became so active with the Historical Society, did so much writing for the review. He was the art teacher. And I remember Jackie Majora and I were in his class. Miss Abbott for English, for senior English, was a wonderful teacher. She was tiny, kind of like a goldfinch, some small, beautiful bird, very prim, but very, very nice, very fun. Miss Iona Peck was the typing teacher I had, and also Frank Kasu was my typing teacher. I think touch typing was about the best course I ever took. I was wrong about Dean Potts. If I had him, I had him for math. I had Raymond Palmer for chemistry, Sidney Duddy for algebra and geometry. I was a hopeless student. Adrian Cobb for physiology, and Miss Cobb was also my counselor. Chuck Crawford for driver's ed. We all loved Mr. Crawford. He was the best teacher, And we were so lucky to have our driver's education with him. I still remember the time that he had to grab the wheel out of my hand as I went around a corner too fast. Ted Mitchell, as I said, oral interpretation. Ed Bode was the drama teacher when I first got into TAM. I didn't do anything in my freshman year except I was the script girl for the senior play. And the senior play was The Man Who Came to Dinner. And it's a wildly funny play. And I had the best time because I was around my brothers, my older brothers' friends. Some of his best friends were in that play. And they were hilarious. Peter Klein then came on staff. And I was in a couple of pieces that he directed. The first one was called Room for One More. I played the mother of a whole bunch of kids and a whole bunch of foster kids. There was always room for one more. And then, and I played, one of the other actors was Carl Weber, whom we called Cappy. He was in my class. He played a character called Jimmy John, who was a very fractious foster kid. And he is now a renowned playwright in Denmark. He went to live in Denmark and writes in Danish. Another drama that I did with Mr. Klein was George Kaufman's The Tavern. And one notable thing about the cast was that Michael Liebert played the stranger, which is the lead role. I played Violet, the crazy woman who suddenly appears. I loved that part. And Michael went on later to co-found what became Berkeley Rep, along with another friend of mine from childhood, Michael Schwarzkopf. And Mikey lived in the Almonte area, and she and Mike Liebert founded Berkeley Rep. And Mike Liebert died, I think he was only around 40, but he was quite a Lothario in high school and a very, very bright guy, lived in Tiburon. Wonderful actor. George Pullman was our history teacher, and he was droll and he wore bow ties. And my French teacher was Erwin Peterson, very, very good looking man. Blonde, kind of a dreamboat, but very aloof. And I asked in that class to be called Robin instead of Abby, because Robin is much more romantic in French than Abby. And then Jean Roberts was our school nurse, and I believe Jean Roberts was, I believe she was the mother of Peggy Roberts and two other sisters who were in one of my mother's classes as younger children. So TAM was, there were so many activities. I didn't get into music there, but I was taking music lessons those years. I took piano lessons from Marion Winkler, who lived in Larkspur and was a wonderful teacher, a concert pianist. I was thinking about some of the other friendships. You know, in those days, we would become friends around an activity. That was, I think it's still probably, even at this age, my friendships come from people with whom I'm doing something as well as from the past. But so we would meet a lot of different kinds of people depending on the clubs we were in. And when the pie came out, our yearbook, we would go through the pie and have everybody sign it. And it was so exciting. If you especially had a boy that you had liked and he wrote something like, "Been great knowing you, love ya." No, I had a few of those. Somebody who'd never given me the time of day. Here is a picture of some of us running for song leader. Lori Giesecke, Susie Gee, me, Bonnie Bruderer, Pat Schneider, Pat I'd known at Alto School. She lived in the Alto area, and Judy Durson.
Let's scan this and label the names at the end.
Definitely.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Let's see, other things about high school. Well, I didn't mention one teacher, Jack Gibson, I had him for an English class, and my brother John had him for journalism. He's the last one. When I was a senior at TAM, I was given a scholarship to go overseas with the experiment in international living to live with a family for a summer. And my friends, Phil Richardson, whom I've mentioned before, Suzanne Rovelli, and Jane Hickman. Well, Jane Hickman went to, she went to France, and she went under the American Field Service. And I think Phil may have gone with the field service as well. But I went with the experiment, and that was a great experience. I was just 17. I was pretty, I wanted to live overseas. All during my childhood, my father had gone overseas almost every other summer, leading study tours to Europe, went to Russia, 1 year, went to Mexico. And so I grew up with a sense that one should travel. So I was delighted to go.
Where'd you go?
Well, I had wanted to go to Scotland for some reason. I don't know why, but Scotland. And I was sent to England. So I was in the county of Norfolk, which is in East Anglia, near a town called Norwich. And I stayed with two families there. We went on a walking trip of the Cotswolds. We walked, and then we would stay in hostels, and then
with a bunch of other little kids? With a bunch of other kids your age?
Yes.
Wow, wonderful.
It was wonderful. And our English counterparts. So it was all very exciting and wonderful. With my second family, a family with four or five children, they had a goat, I remember. And one of the things I learned how to do was to milk a goat. So in so many ways, they were the perfect family for me, just wonderful people. And so it was a very good experience. So I came back and I went right into college, the College of the Pacific in Stockton, which had been my mother's school. She had gone there, and she was very strong on that being the right place for me. I was very close to my mother, and I don't think I rebelled, almost not at all, when I was a teenager. That I did later, but not then. So I went to College of the Pacific. I stayed in the women's dorm, and it was a very good place.
Wait,
for
that,
me.
Was that co-ed then?
The dorm was not co-ed.
But the school was co-ed.
The school was co-ed. I think the school had always been co-ed, unless it started out, you know, in the first few years. But my mother had been there in the, let's see, that would have been the 20s, early 20s. So it was co-ed then. Notable at College of the Pacific was an interest in religion. There was a chapel that was mandatory, so we went to chapel every week. An interest in philosophy. I had a couple of really good philosophy teachers. And speech and drama. I was in a play there, Jean-Paul Sartre's No Exit was the play that was put on. It's a very intense one-act play. And I took piano lessons from Edward Shadbolt. And I remember the only recital I ever played in, I was so frightened, that I was so nervous, that I almost walked off stage, but I managed to muddle through. And that was a nervousness about performing that I carried with me for many, many years. Just, I could play, if you were here in my house and you were talking to someone, I could play without nervousness. But if you were sitting and listening to me, I would, you know, start to make mistakes, and then I would be down on myself. So Mrs. Winkler had been a wonderful piano teacher. Edward Shadbolt was much more exacting, and I wasn't a very good student, even though I loved the piano. I suppose I told you about going to sleep in this house to the sounds, two main sounds, the sound of the piano and the sound of the typewriter, you know, and those continue to be sounds I really love, although we don't hear the typewriter anymore. I didn't major in anything at College of Pacific. I just took the liberal arts courses and enjoyed them a lot, and went to COP for 2 years, and the second year I joined a sorority. And the sorority I joined was a local called Tau Kappa Kappa, and midway in the year, they became a national. And that meant all kinds of different rules. And I remember that the sororities at College of Pacific, except for one, which was off campus, all of the big sororities, even when they were locals, were discriminatory. There was one girl who was
against two,
against blacks.
Just okay.
Yeah. And not against Jews, I believe. I don't think so. And I think that was on the way out when, you know, I don't know when the Nationals changed their policies, but they must have changed their policies in the 60s. So here we were in 1959, 1960, and I decided that I wanted to quit school after my sophomore year and act for a year in a theater company that was owned by a Belvedere resident called Martha Bigelow Elliott. And it had been going on for a long, long time. It was a traveling children's theater company called the San Francisco Players Guild. And Marty Elliott was a friend of my mother's and father's, she and her husband Ted. And so that was kind of the way that I steered into that. And my parents didn't object to my taking a year off, which I was grateful for. I did take a year off. I played one of the ugly stepsisters in Cinderella and made some friends who remained friends for life. Wonderful actors like Sally Sherman Taylor from Mill Valley. Her mother and father both have oral histories in the history room. Sally still lives in Mill Valley. She was a wonderful actress, and she played the other stepsister. And then Alice Perry from Sausalito, who played our mother, the mean stepmother. Nothing could be further from the truth of Alice. And we went out on the road every day, 5 days a week. I drove the company car. At 18, I think they were very brave to let me do that. I only remember one near accident. But I would pick up other members of the company, and then the rest of the company would come in a big truck, and they would bring the stanchions and the set, you know, the portable set, and we would go to mostly elementary schools, sometimes to institutions. We went to Laguna Honda, I remember. We played for maybe a retirement home or a place for developmentally disabled adults, but mostly for kids. We would set up, we would have a show usually in the morning, eat lunch that we had packed, have a show in the afternoon, pack up and take off. And that's what I did for 9 months.
With the same play, or did you do a bunch of different plays?
Just the same play. We got pretty good at it, but one time I actually went on stage with my rather scruffy slippers on instead of the shoes that I was supposed to be wearing, because I just hadn't been thinking about my entrance, and I was sitting in the dressing room and kind of jumped up. Oh, my turn. It had gotten a bit too rote, so I figured I had to refresh.
So then you went back to school?
Then I went back to school. However, I didn't go back to COP. I decided, my parents had been very strong about my becoming a teacher, and I thought that was a really good idea. Along in here, when I was a college student, I had done, I had directed the Junior Theater of Marin. And we did a play at Reed School with children. So I had really enjoyed that. I'd actually written a play based on The Ugly Duckling. It even had songs in it. And the mothers made the costumes, and we put it on at Reed School, and it was really quite a hit. It's great fun. It was called A Duckling's Tale.
And you wrote the whole... You were college age when you did that?
Yes. I think so.
And you wrote the songs also?
Well, the songs, I'm not sure about the songs. I'd have to refresh my memory. I have a copy of the script somewhere, but they probably were the simplest kind of songs you can imagine. You know, simpler than Hans Christian Andersen. You know, the movie had those very lovely songs that were based on his stories. And I had seen that Danny Kaye film when I was a kid, one of those times that my brothers and I went to the matinee. And he was my favorite, Danny Kaye. So maybe, you know, that must have had some influence. I decided to go back to school, and I decided to go to San Francisco State College because they had a marvelous elementary education program. And actually, I lucked out. I think because by that time, my mother was an educator, and she had gone back to school and gotten her master's degree in education. And she, after I was at State, she taught there. She supervised student teachers and taught a couple of classes. But that was after I left college. I think maybe the master's degree was after I left college too, but she had always been very involved with some of the more prominent educators of for elementary school when she was an elementary school teacher. And she would have human relations workshops over here at the house. People would come over, and they were always so interesting and so kind to us kids. And I was lucky. What I'm referring to is that San Francisco State had a brand new program that was funded by, I believe, the National Mental Health Association, and it was a non-graded elementary education project called the Teacher Education Project. So I entered that program, and I was there for 2 years. And then had the choice of what to do afterwards. I had lived in San Francisco off and on, but had never really enjoyed San Francisco that much.
Were you living here in Mill Valley when you went to SF State?
I was part of the time. I had lived in San Francisco when I was with the San Francisco Players Guild. But then during college, I didn't live in the dorm. I think I was at home during that time. Although there was a period that I lived in San Francisco with a friend from high school, Judy McClure. We rented an apartment on Laguna and Broadway. I had told you about the Broadway boarding house.
About Laguna and Broadway.
I said the boarding house. Yeah, the boarding house was just up the street from the apartment that Judy and I rented. Judy and I had lived together at the boarding house at Laguna and Broadway. And this place was just down the street. So part of the time I was going to State, I was undoubtedly living on Laguna, one of those places. And then
pretty nice address.
Really nice address. I remember there was an earthquake while we were in the in the apartment down the street from Broadway on Laguna. There was an earthquake early in the morning. And I remember waking up and thinking, oh my God, there's a giant outside shaking the apartment building. And then I realized it was an earthquake. And it wasn't too bad. And I didn't get out of bed. I just stayed in bed and waited for it to be over. Okay. At this point, when I lived in the Laguna house, I fell in love with a Chilean writer, a young man. He was just my age, just 18 or 19 years old. And he was going to go to Mexico with some of his friends from California. And this was at the time that I was working in the theater group. So now I'm beginning to get my bearings. I was living in the apartment on Laguna down from the boarding house when I was working with the San Francisco Players Guild. So that's when Judy and I were sharing a place. And I remember that he urged me to go to Mexico with them, but I couldn't do it. I had a responsibility to be in the play. I had, you know, that was my work. I couldn't just leave. And I remember wondering if I were a different person or didn't have my family nearby, you know, who knew my employer, if I would have gone to Mexico, just taken off and, you know, been a free spirit. But anyway, I didn't, and I'm sure it's just as well that I didn't. Finished out that year, went back to school at State. And then when graduation was coming along fast, I applied for a teaching job in Alaska. But at the same time, I applied for the Peace Corps. I'd been very moved by John F. Kennedy's address. And I loved the whole idea of living overseas. So I decided, instead of going to Alaska, and there were many opportunities for teachers in those days. I mean, there were opportunities in Berkeley and in Mill Valley, and there were opportunities all over that there are no longer. Or there were times when it was very difficult to get a teaching job, but then it was wide open and I could have gone anywhere. But I decided to go into the Peace Corps, and I think I may have said that I'd like to go to South America, and that's where they sent me. So I was assigned in the fall of 1963, right after I graduated, because I didn't graduate until after the summer. I had a course to make up, something like that. So right after I graduated, I went to Albuquerque, New Mexico for training with an educational television project in Bogota, Colombia. And I spent, I think we were in training for 2 months in Albuquerque. And then in January of 1964, we left for Bogota. What happened right before I left was I had my heart in my throat. I thought maybe I wasn't going to be able to go because the Peace Corps had found out that my parents had been very radical in the 40s and very early 50s, and especially my mother, and they were doing a security clearance. So they were collecting information, and my passport was on hold. So I couldn't leave until I was cleared. And I had not been an activist particularly at all. The only thing I'd done besides Junior Statesmen and Young Democrats was to take part in a protest against the House Un-American Activities Committee. And that would have been around 1960 in San Francisco. And that was the time that the police put fire hoses against the protesters. Some of them, in my memory, some of them were actually hit by fire hoses, but my memory may be faulty there. I'll have to look that up. Anyway, that was about the only thing I'd done. I wasn't a radical. I wasn't very political, actually. And I did get the clearance. One of the staff from Peace Corps Washington and I had hit it off. Ted Myers, he'd come out and been with our group for a little while, and Ted helped get it through. He vouched for me. So we all arrived in Bogota and commenced being newbies in a place. We had had very, very good Spanish training, but it was the first time I'd ever spoken Spanish. And there we were in Colombia, which was a much, much less violent country than it is now, although I think things have improved. But it has gone through some tremendous upheavals and a lot of violence. But in those days, it was pretty safe. I never felt threatened, except with theft. There would be pickpockets on the street, and you had to be very careful. If you were driving a Jeep, we had a Jeep. I didn't drive it, but in Bogota, and you had your arm casually on the window, and you were stopped at a stoplight, somebody might come up behind you, grab your watch off your wrist, and take off. But I think my pocket was only picked once. And, but I'll tell more about that another time, if it's of interest. So do you want to continue? Or do you want to... the Peace Corps was one option in some very activist years for American youth. There were those who went to Selma. There were those who had been on freedom riders on buses. There were those of us who went overseas, either, or we were in domestic Peace Corps. So overseas was my choice, and I've never regretted it. I worked for 6 months in educational television in Bogota, working in elementary schools with elementary teachers who were just learning how to utilize the television sets that had been provided by the Alliance for Progress. The program had three facets: the technicians who kept the televisions going, the programmers who worked with the Colombian counterparts to create programming in Spanish, of course, and then the utilization people, and that was my group. There were about 50 of us who went down.
Wait, what is utilization?
Utilization mean? Of the programs. So that you saw the program, the teachers and their children watched a program, let's say it was on language arts. And then we were mostly teachers who had been trained in the United States, and we then would help them figure out, what do we do with this? Because what they didn't want, the people who conceived of the program, what they didn't want was that the teacher would have the kids sit in front of the TV set, watch the program, and then go on to something else. They wanted to help them figure out how to incorporate and integrate the programming into their school curriculum. So that's what we were there for. And I met some wonderful teachers. I remember the first time the teachers asked me to stay for lunch, and they served a potato soup with cilantro, and it was the first time I'd ever tasted cilantro, and it was so good. I remember loving it right from the very beginning. It took about 6 months for my Spanish to become fluent after 2 months of intensive Spanish training in Albuquerque. But, you know, being out in the field and talking with people was just the best, and being in Bogota was especially good because in Colombia, the clearest, cleanest Spanish, is the most elegant Spanish, is spoken in the central part of the country. And the Bogotanos are very proud of their Spanish. So it was a great place for me to be. However, I went to visit some Peace Corps friends who lived in the countryside, way up in the mountains near Popayan, the city of Popayan, which is south of Bogota. And I decided that I wanted to change programs, and I wanted to be in a rural setting and doing community development like they were doing. So it was very willful of me because I'd been trained in one program. However, my director, who was Christopher Sheldon, he was the Peace Corps director in Colombia at that time, said if I wanted to do that, I could do that, but that I would have to get the okay of the director of CARE Peace Corps. Peace Corps at that time contracted CARE to administer many of its programs. Peace Corps had very little expertise, so they turned to other agencies to help them out. And CARE had many, many years in the field, especially with self-help projects and development projects. Well, the new director of the CARE Peace Corps program, who had just arrived in the country, was named William Raymond, R-A-Y-M-A-N. And Bill was from Cleveland, Ohio, and he'd been working for CARE for many years. But he was totally new. So one of the first things that he was confronted with at a conference that I went to in order to make my request was that I wanted to get into community development. And he told me later that I was just a pain in the neck at that point. But he said it was okay too. So now with Chris Sheldon saying yes and Bill saying yes, I left the educational television program, left Bogota, and went up to the back of beyond, which is La Guajira, which was not even a proper state at that time. It was the next step down. It had very little government. It had very little amenities. It was very primitive. No electricity except one or two families who had a power plant, a generator in there for their shop. No running water except in a couple of homes where the people had more money and had put in running water. No toilets. I don't know if anybody had a toilet. There were outhouses. And it was in the most beautiful area on the coast of Colombia. My little town was called Dibuya. And so a number of years ago, I went back to see it, and it had greatly changed. And yet some of the same people that I knew were still there, which was wonderful. So I was in Dibuya for a year and a half working in community development. Before going, however, I trained with two wonderful women who were doing a health and community project on the coast of Colombia. And one of them is now one of our Superior Court judges. That was Faye Hooker.
Oh.
And her name now is Faye Diopel. And she is still a very good friend. And she and her partner, Joan Mansfield, who was, they worked together. They put me up. They taught me a lot and became friends for life. So I was in Dibuya working with trying to get a girls club going, trying to get latrines built, trying to get the school up and running. There were a number of projects. I don't think I was particularly effective in any one of them. A lot of the time I was working by myself, which is not the best way to do it. I had a couple of site partners who were men, and one of them, Howard Converse, lives in Oakland now, and I've seen him a couple of times. But Howard left to become a volunteer leader, and I was alone in the site until Willie Dow arrived. Willie's from the East Coast. But I settled into the life of Dibuya. I learned how to dance the cumbia. My Spanish became very fluent. It was quite a wonderful time. And I got to know Bill Raymond better. He did a site visit. We fell in love. And when I finished my Peace Corps service in 1965, in the winter of 65, I came home, stayed with my parents for about a month, and then Bill came up. We had an engagement party here in Mill Valley, And then we both went back to Colombia, and I had a job teaching school in Bogota then, until Bill was transferred from his position as CARE Peace Corps director. He was transferred to be CARE director in Turkey. And so we left in 1966. We had gotten married in February of 66 in Bogota in a little church there. And none of my family was there. It was, my mother had visited me one time during the Peace Corps time. And she had come to the coast and we'd had a lovely time together. But she either couldn't afford to come down or just, I don't know, it was a long way to travel. But my husband's mother did come. She lived in Florida, much closer. So she came down for the wedding. And Joan Mansfield, one of the people I'd trained with, came and was my maid of honor. I had a very traditional wedding, except that I chose the music, but I forgot to get anybody to run the tape recorder. So the music was turned on, and there was a bit of music for each part of the service. And by the time it was my entrance, all the music was gone. So that was... I wasn't very good at delegating responsibility back then. So Bill and I left in June of 1966 for Turkey, and we took a delayed honeymoon. We went on the SS France to, I can't remember the port. It wasn't Marseille. I'll remember it later, but we went by ship. We got to France, and Bill had bought a car, and so we picked up the car and we drove to Turkey, and it was a wonderful trip, and I was seeing all those places for the first time. We got to Turkey and we settled into a house in Ankara, and there our first child was born.
What year?
November of 66. So that baby was real soon. And his name is Graham Ashley Raymond. And while he was very little, I had my own little preschool for children, mostly of people who were living there as part of the AID or another US program. But there were also occasional Turkish children in the group. I had my preschool there for pretty much all the time we were in Turkey, and we were there for 2 years. I studied Turkish. I took Turkish 5 days a week at the Foreign Service Institute. Loved learning the language, and loved being a mother. And we did a couple of nice trips around Turkey. We went to Cappadocia, went to Istanbul, and it was just a very exotic, wonderful place. We went to Antalya, Aphrodisias, Pamukkale, places like that. So in 1968, summer, Bill was transferred. And that was kind of the story of his life, is he would be in a place, he would do a bang-up job, and then he would be transferred. They never let him stay in one place very long. He was transferred to Honduras, and he was glad to get back to Latin America, and so was I. Bill had lived in Bolivia before he lived in Colombia, and so we went, I think we stopped in California on our way down, visited. My mother did come to Turkey. She traveled to Turkey when after the baby was born, and by this time my parents we're getting a divorce. Yeah, 67, I think it was. So my mother came by herself, and she always came to any country I was in one time. She even came to Nigeria later. So we moved to Honduras, and we lived there for 3 years, and this is where our second son, Joshua William Raymond, was born. And
date,
yes. Josh was born March 10th, 1969. Graham was born November 20th, 1966. Yeah, I just didn't say the day before. Honduras was wonderful. We made some awfully good friends there. And one of them was a Franciscan priest who was at that time, he was working in Honduras for the church. He was the priest who was in charge of the Catholic members of the American Embassy. And he and an Episcopal priest from England and a sister, maybe a Dominican sister, who was, or Mary Knoll, sister was down there, an American. We, with some of the other American families, started a discussion group. It started out as a religious group to talk about theology. I was interested in theology. Bill wasn't, but I was. So I was part of that group with the priest, Gratian Buttarazzi, and Father Pat Hurley, and Sister Marilyn, and so on, and then some Americans who were not affiliated with the church. And that became the nucleus of my social life. I also taught school. I taught first grade in a local school. But that didn't work out too well because I had the two-year-old and then I had the new baby. So I didn't teach for very long. But we lived in a beautiful place up on a hill above Tegucigalpa. And my baby had been born in Turkey in a Turkish hospital. And I had a Turkish gynecologist, obstetrician, Kaya Aydar. And in Honduras, we had a Honduran obstetrician, and Josh was born in a Honduran hospital. And those were very good experiences. After Honduras, and my father visited us in Honduras, and one of the things that meant most to him was that we had Israeli friends, and there was a Jewish holiday, which we had never observed in our home. My father had not cared about such things during those years. My mother would have been willing, but my father didn't really care. And in Honduras, our Israeli friends invited us to a party for Rosh Hashanah or something wonderful. And my father heard the music and he ate the food and he was in heaven. It was really meaningful to him. That was one of the great pleasures of my life, was to give, you know, to give pleasure to your parent. My mother was very easy to give pleasure to. All I had to do was make her room when she would stay with us beautiful, put flowers in it and make it look lovely for her. And it just pleased her no end. And I would take her to visit friends of mine, educators in Turkey or friends in Honduras who had something in common with her. But my father had not visited us overseas. So when I was able to give him the joy of that party, that really meant something. After Honduras, we were assigned to, that was 3 years we were there in Honduras. So we really settled in. The children were doing pretty well and Bill was doing well. The earthquake in Peru happened in 1970 and Kerr sent him down for a month to Peru. There had been terrible mudslides and awful results of the earthquake, this tremendous earthquake. A whole village buried in a mudslide and terrible damage. So Bill went down to direct the relief efforts there, and he was gone for a month. Honduras was a place where we had a live-in housekeeper who helped with the children. I did a lot of baking and cooking there. I baked bread and croissants and all kinds of things. Had a lot of leisure time. And my mother-in-law, Janet Raymond, came down and visited us at least once. Then we went to Nigeria. And Nigeria was a really tough experience. It was different than the other places. Although in those days, it had a very stable, in many ways, a very stable government under the leadership of Yakubu Gowon, who was a military man, a general, but he was... the country was pretty stable. There wasn't the terrible violence and strife that there is now. In fact, Honduras is in Latin America is just about the most violent country of all. At the time we were there, it was very, very peaceful. Nigeria in a terrible, terrible situation. And Turkey is going through a lot of changes right now. And Colombia has been through the mill. So it's sad to think about the places that our lives were so good, being so terrible for so many people. We lived in Lagos for a year, and Bill directed the care program there. I remember it was always my habit to go and introduce myself to my neighbors. And I went around with my children. We walked around the neighborhood in Lagos and knocked on doors. And there was almost no one who was really welcoming there. One family, maybe one or two, among the rich people who lived in the area where we lived.
Were they white or black?
They were black. They were Nigerians. But the people who were friendly were the very poor people who lived right across the street. It was so ironic to live in this posh neighborhood with huge houses, and right across the street, and not a very wide street, there was a big slum with very, very modest to very poor housing for people. One or two faucets for hundreds of people to share, public faucets, and no sanitation facilities. And this was right across the street, but my closest Nigerian friend, I had two good Nigerian friends, but one of them was from Falamo, which was the name of this slum area, and lived immediately across the street, and she came over to introduce herself to me. And one time I remember brought a cooked chicken to us, which was so kind and so, I mean, chicken was not cheap for someone like Agnes. Her name was Agnes. So my other Nigerian, close Nigerian friend was from a very different strata of society. She was an actress, and I had met her through a play that we had gone to in Lagos. I loved being there. I really enjoyed it. It was tough because nobody was, you know, bowing and scraping to us. We were barely tolerated foreigners. But the friends that we made were really deep friendships. And many of them were African Americans who were stationed in Nigeria and lived near us, lived across the street on the other side. A couple of them, Joanne and Art Patrick, who worked for AID, became very close friends. There was a teacher named Clotilde Reed who became very close with us. And so what I enjoyed in Nigeria was an integrated community, a larger community of people from all over the world, including Nigerians, but including many Americans, whose paths might or might not have crossed mine in the States. So that was a joy. And we did a lot of entertaining. We went to other people's homes for dinner. I learned how to dance, to really move, you know, to move my whole body instead of keeping my body straight and still, because the Nigerian dancing was so wonderful and free. So that was a great experience. And my mother came and visited us there. As I said, there were hard times, but on the whole, when Bill decided to come back to the States and take a leave of absence from care, he and I said to each other, there are so many people who have a really, really hard time adjusting to Lagos, and here we are, and we've adjusted, and we've learned how to live here, and now we're going. And we were both sorry about that. When I was there, I taught a drama workshop class, so I was keeping my hand into drama and decided that when we went back to the States, I would get a master's degree in theater. So we went, Bill had a friend who was an investment advisor in Stamford, Connecticut, and in 1972, we traveled back to the States and set up our household in Riverside, Connecticut. We lived for a time also before we got that house in a winter rental on the beach in a place called Saugatuck. And I remember being so lonesome for different colors of people there. I mean, literally, I felt deprived. I made friends with the man whose family owned the refuse collection. And he was a lovely African-American guy. And you know, I just gravitated towards that warm, I mean, it sounds strange, and I don't mean it to sound patronizing, but Connecticut was really, really, really white and rather cold, and cold when we got there. My best friends there were a Jewish woman from New York who was kind of out of her element, and an Englishman from England who was a music buff and was out of his element. So we gravitated towards one another. We lived in Saugatuck and then in Riverside, Connecticut, and for a couple of years while I went to New York University to get a degree. I had tried out for Yale School of Drama and auditioned there, and they asked me if I would be a special student, if I was willing to be a special student, which meant I wouldn't have gotten any credit. I could have gone through the School of Drama, but I wouldn't have gotten any credit towards teaching. And I had thought that I wanted to teach drama. So I turned, it wasn't exactly an offer, but it was a question that they had for me. And I decided—
You're gonna have to pay for that?
Oh yes.
Then why would you do that?
Yeah, exactly. Well, that was what Bill and I felt too. So instead I applied for New York University in their School of Educational Theater, which was more right on track. And I studied there for a year and a half or so, and then we moved to Washington, D.C. when Bill got another job. In the meantime, in 1973, the stock market had gone way, way down, and Bill's firm, the investment advising firm that he had with his friend, Jim Nash, went pretty much south. A lot of money was lost, and they felt terribly responsible for that. And I don't know if Jim ever picked up the business after that, but Bill decided that he wanted to go back to, not to overseas, but he wanted to get another job. So we moved to Washington, D.C. in 1974. And I had about 6 months to do on my master's degree, so I enrolled at Catholic University for my final work. And I didn't go to my graduation from college at San Francisco State because it would have been the June after I was already in Columbia. And I didn't go to my graduation from New York University either because I was then living in Washington and I guess I felt it didn't matter. Too many people. So we moved to a house in Chevy Chase, Maryland, and built had a new job with a, it was five or six cooperatives that worked overseas that had come together into an organization, and Bill was their executive secretary. They included the Rural Electrification Cooperative and other cooperatives that had to do with housing and development in overseas, in third world countries. And I finished my work, you know, and was a mother, and that for the next year. And then I was in a play. I played the lead role in a play called Approaching Simone by Megan Terry in the Washington Area Feminist Theater. And that was an interesting experience because Simone Veil was a philosopher, and that little string of philosophy kind of goes through my life. My father was a philosopher. My son is a philosopher. And I had always liked philosophy studies. But maybe that's enough for now.
Okay.